The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Today we're thinking about the end of the world. The Mayan calendar is due to conclude next month. And some have interpreted this to mean the end of the world. So, will the world end? What are we to make of these claims? Shortly, today's presenter, Peter Orr, will help us think through these questions. And just to let you know what's going to happen today, I'm going to quickly introduce Peter. I'm going to read a short section of the Bible, and then Peter will give a 15 to 20 minute presentation. I'm going to share some news, and then we'll open the floor up for questions, comments, and interaction. This is a forum. We welcome all opinions, and we very much look forward to that time. You can ask questions either via SMS to the number provided, or you can ask from the floor. Now, we're also very conscious that this is your lunchtime, and we'll make sure that we're all done by about 20 past one in order to get back for a very productive afternoon of labour. But you're very welcome to stay longer as you like. There's some lunch available at a bookstore which you can browse as well. I'd like to now read the passage of the Bible. Which is before, and then I'll introduce our speaker. Actually, I'll introduce our speaker, Peter Orr, first, and then I'll read the passage of the Bible. Peter is originally from Northern Ireland, and that's why he will speak a little bit funny. He's worked in IT and worked with churches in the UK, Romania, and Australia. His research has involved study into the end times, and he currently lectures at Melbourne School of Theology. We're delighted that he can come today, and we'll welcome him just as he comes to speak for us in a second. On the inside, you should have received an outline when you came in. Inside there's a part of the Bible printed from the Gospel of Mark. And I'm going to read the last two paragraphs there from sentence 28. Jesus says, "From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see these things taking place, you know that he is near at the very gates. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. But concerning that day or that hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Be on guard, keep awake, for you do not know when the time will come. It is like a man going on a journey. When he leaves home, he puts his servants in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to stay awake. Therefore, stay awake. For you do not know when the master of the house will come, in the evening or at midnight, or when the rooster crows, or in the morning, lest he come suddenly and find you asleep. And what I say to you, I say to all, stay awake." Please welcome Peter Orr.
Well, thanks very much for this chance to come and share this presentation with you this afternoon. As Robert mentioned, according to one reading of the Mayan calendar, the world will end on December the 21st, 2012. I wonder how you react to the idea of the Mayan apocalypse, as it's called. A little bit of doubt, anxiety, fear, derision, humor. I guess most of the world will simply ignore the idea of the world ending on the 21st of December and ignore the idea that anyone can predict that the world will end suddenly on a particular day. And yet, there is a little part of us, if we're honest, that just checks ourselves. We might not be afraid of the 21st of December, but the idea that the world will end one day isn't all that crazy. It doesn't take too much imagination to envisage the scenario where a rogue state obtains nuclear or biological weapons, or climate change reaches an irreversible tipping point, or we get hit by a big enough asteroid. The idea that the world will end on the 21st of December 2012 might seem to most of us unbelievable, but the idea that the world will end catastrophically and suddenly, well, that's not so crazy. Certainly Hollywood seems to make a bit of money out of the idea. Think of the movies that deal with the end of the world: Armageddon, 12 Monkeys, Dawn of the Dead, Terminator, Doctor Strangelove, War of the Worlds, Terminator 2, Melancholia, The Road, Miracle Mile, Terminator 3. The idea of the world ending is something that resonates with us on some level. It's not something that we can entirely write off. What I want to do for our time together is just briefly think about what the Bible says about the end of the world. The Bible actually says a lot about the end of the world. But what you find in the Bible is not the sort of Mayan apocalypse-specific predictions. Rather, the Bible's general teaching is that this world belongs to God's, to God. It is His world, and He will bring it to an end one day, and we need to be ready. Now, we don't have time to look at all the Bible's teaching, so what I want us to do is just look at something that Jesus Himself taught. Now, I don't know many of you. I imagine that we're a fairly eclectic audience here today. But what I hope is that even if you're someone who wouldn't call yourself a Christian, but by the end of today, you at least are very clear on the Christian teaching on the end of the world, on what Jesus said. That is my aim, so at least you will know exactly what Jesus taught about the end of the world. And you'll see that Jesus' teaching is very different to the Mayan apocalypse kind of idea. Because he doesn't talk about dates, he actually focuses on himself. The end of the world, according to Jesus, is all about Jesus. So if you want to grab that piece of paper with the passage, I'll just be referring to that as we go. But just to set the scene, this passage is from near the end of the Gospel of Mark, Mark's account of the life of Jesus. And Jesus has just told his disciples that he is going to Jerusalem to die. And Jesus teaches that his death means salvation for those who trust in him, but it also means judgment for those who reject him. And that includes the people of Jerusalem, and this chapter deals with that judgment. And so at the beginning of our chapter, we have Jesus leaving the temple in Jerusalem for the last time, and he utters words of judgment. The disciples comment on the grandeur of the temple, and Jesus replies, verse 2, "Do you see these great buildings? There will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." Jesus' death is going to bring Jerusalem under the judgment of God, and that will mean the destruction of the temple. And that prompts his disciples to ask him two questions. Verse 4, "When will these things be? And what will be the sign when all these things are about to be accomplished?" Now, there's something deeper behind their questions than a simple curiosity to know when the temple will be destroyed. Listen to their second question again. What will be the sign when all these things are about to be accomplished? Jesus knows they're asking more than simply when the temple will be destroyed. They understand that the destruction of the temple is somehow bound up, connected with the end of the world. So at the end of our passage, we have the language of stars falling from heaven, powers in the heavens being shaken. So Jesus understands the destruction of the temple to be connected to his return and the end of the world. And that's the key to this passage. But how do we get there from the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem to the end of the world when Jesus returns? Well, we'll see that as we go. In each section, we see Jesus warn the disciples. Now, firstly, he warns them not to speculate about signs. Jesus' great concern is that they'll not be led astray. So verse 5, Jesus began to say to them, "See that no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name saying, 'I am he,' and they will lead many astray." Many people have come in the name of Jesus, claiming to represent him. But Jesus goes on to warn them. Verse 7, "When you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is not yet. Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places, and there will be famines." False teachers claiming to be Jesus himself could easily make them think that the end had come, that Jesus had returned. And given that in the Old Testament, wars, famines, and earthquakes were associated with God's intervention in history, it would be very tempting to think that the end had come when those things happened. But Jesus is clear, verse 8. These are but the beginning of the birth pains. Deception, international conflict, natural disasters are not the signs of God's final judgment. They are only the beginning of the end, according to Jesus. So Jesus wants them to be clear, to not be led astray, to think that a war or an earthquake or a very convincing false prophet meant that the world was ending. And so I think these verses challenge the Christian mentality. Some Christians have the mentality that they're obsessed with the signs of the times. There are Christians who obsess about this war or that earthquake as a sign that Jesus is about to return. You can go to conferences, you can read magazines, you can visit websites that are obsessed with fitting current events in with the Bible. But all too often they ultimately miss Jesus' emphasis. And we're to expect these events. And rather than make us curious or become obsessed with them, Jesus wants his followers, verse 13, to endure to the end, just to keep going as Christians. One article I read contained some catastrophic predictions about the price of crude oil going up. And it's a Christian article, and it started with the words, "Be afraid, be very afraid." But that seems to go against the whole nature of this passage. Did you notice verse 7 where Jesus specifically tells them, "Do not be alarmed"? Now, Jesus has warned his disciples about these things, not to make them afraid, but quite the opposite, to realize these things will be commonplace, and that as Christians endure so that they can keep going to the end. Now, Jesus shows that the reason for their enduring is not just so that they would make it to the end, verse 13, but because, verse 10, the gospel, the good news of Jesus, must first be proclaimed to all nations. Now, it's important to notice that according to the New Testament, there is a sense in which this has already happened. Paul, in his letter to the Colossians, can say that all over the world, the gospel is bearing fruit and growing. Luke in Acts 2 can say that at the day of Pentecost, there were Jews, devout men from every nation under heaven, who had the gospel preached to them. So in a sense, we can say that the gospel has been preached to every nation. And yet it's clear that the job is not finished. And proclaiming the gospel, telling people the good news about Jesus, is what Jesus' followers are meant to be doing while they wait for the end, not being obsessed with trying to calculate when he will return, but obsessed with making sure that everyone gets the opportunity to hear the good news of Jesus. So, firstly, don't speculate about signs, but then secondly, don't miss the one sign. If wars, earthquakes, famines, and false Christs are not the sign of the end, Jesus points out the one thing that must happen before the end, the destruction of the temple. Jesus gives us what seems to be a cryptic warning, verse 14. "When you see the abomination of desolation standing where it ought not to be, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." Now, the abomination of desolation is a reference to the Old Testament. Now, might seem cryptic to us, but the original hearers and readers of Mark's Gospel, who would have known their Old Testament very well, would have recognized the phrase from the Old Testament book of Daniel. In our own culture, we have phrases that are slightly cryptic, but most people know what they're referring to. So I haven't read Harry Potter, but I believe that if you refer to he who must not be named, that is referring to a slightly scary character in Harry Potter. In the same way, the original audience would have understood the phrase, "the abomination that causes desolation," to be a reference to Daniel. And in Daniel, it's used three times, and each time it's connected with the idea of the desecration of the temple and introduction of non-Jewish sacrifices. So it's as if the phrase means pagan worship in the temple. So Jesus is saying, when you see pagan worship in the temple, you know the end is near. And crucially for Jesus, it's this, not wars, famines, or earthquakes. This is the sign that the temple will be destroyed, and it is this sign that anticipates the end of the world. Now, there's been a lot of ink spilled about exactly when this desecration actually occurred or what it specifically refers to, possibly Titus, Roman general, entering the temple in AD 70 and setting up pagan Roman standards. But the key issue is that by the time the temple was destroyed in AD 70, Jesus' words had come true. So thirdly, the third thing that Jesus wants to make sure is that the disciples are ready, Christians are ready. See, Jesus jumps in time from the destruction of the temple to his final return. And there are three things he wants us to grasp. First of all, his return will be catastrophic. Verse 24, "In those days after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers in the heavens will be shaken." The picture is of the entire structure of the universe breaking up, the sun, the moon, the stars. And more than that, the heavenly powers, the spiritual rulers of the universe, being knocked out of place. This is no hiccup, no temporary blip. The universe, as we know it, Jesus is claiming, will never be the same. So Jesus is teaching us that when he returns, that will be it. Game over. The woman on her phone making a deal, well, the phone will go dead, the world will stop, and she'll be confronted with Jesus. The man driving the kids to school, the car will stop, the universe will crumble around him, and he will be standing before the Lord Jesus. The couple having a meal in the restaurant will look up, and that will be it. There will be no more time. The world will end. Jesus has returned, and they will face him. The cleaner, the school teacher, the lawyer, the mother, the farmer, the woman swimming laps in the pool, the guys playing football, that will be it. There will be no time. The world will end. The return of Jesus, according to the New Testament, will be a day of wrath and judgment, a day when the world is called to account, a terrible day. Yet these words of Jesus, he is not scaring us. He is being kind to us in warning us that this is what will happen when he returns. And he continues to prepare those who read this. Verses 28 to 31, Jesus' return is near. Verse 30, I think, is the key to tying the destruction of the temple to Jesus' return. Verse 30, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. All these things, all the things that Jesus had spoken about, the destruction of the temple, famines, wars, even the preaching of the gospel, as we said, have happened. And they happened before that generation died out. And as such, there's nothing left to happen before Jesus returns. Verse 29, so also, when you see these things taking place, you know that he is near, at the very gates. Or just like we can tell the seasons from the way nature responds, verse 28, from the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. When you see the fig tree's leaves come out, you know that summer is near. When you see the temple being destroyed, according to Jesus, you know the end is near. Now, the obvious question, Jesus said this 2,000 years ago. The temple was destroyed shortly afterwards in AD 70. How could Jesus have said his return would be near? What did he mean by that? Well, I guess the Western view of time is based on minutes, hours, days. We live by our watches. However, the Bible's view of time seems to telescope hours and minutes and is concerned with events. It is concerned with the progression of events. Jesus' view of time here is event-based. It's as if, and I don't mean this irreverently, but it's as if in God's diary, the next event that is marked is the return of Jesus. There is nothing in his diary before the return of Jesus. There is nothing left to happen. The sign of the destruction of the temple has happened. Everything that Jesus mentioned in this chapter has happened. The end is coming. The catastrophic return of Jesus is imminent. But more than simply being near, Jesus' return will be unexpected. Because the sign has already happened, that means there won't be any more warning. The time is totally unknown. Jesus even says in verse 32 that he doesn't know. Only God the Father knows. The response, though, is clear. Verse 33, be on guard, keep awake, for you do not know when the time will come. Verse 35, therefore, stay awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come. Verse 37, and what I say to you, I say to all, stay awake. Be on your guard, stay awake, keep awake, stay awake. Jesus couldn't be clearer. We're not to fall asleep like a servant who falls asleep when his master expects him to be on duty. What exactly does it mean that we're to stay awake, to be on our guard? Well, if you think of the servant who's falling asleep on duty, he's saying to himself, my master is not coming back for ages. In fact, he's really living as if his master isn't coming back at all. So for Jesus, falling asleep means living as if Jesus was never going to return. Living life as if we're confident that we can do our own thing until maybe we're about to die and then we sort things out with God. Living as if our priority is not serving the Lord, but getting our own thing done. Living as if that holiday, that new job, that car, that sporting event is what really matters. Letting these things, as good, appropriate, as helpful as they are, dominate our horizon. On the other hand, according to Jesus, staying awake means living as if he could return at any moment. Trusting him, living with his agenda, ensuring the gospel continues to be preached. Well, you're back in the office and the phone rings. It's your boss. He's been out for the morning, but he tells you, I'm on my way. He's given the sign that he's returning. His return is near, but it will also be unexpected. You don't know the exact moment that he'll return. 10 minutes, 15 minutes, an hour? How are you going to respond? Maybe it doesn't faze you at all. You just keep working on the report like you have been since he left. Or maybe you say, oh, I guess I can relax a bit longer. I'll just take that power nap before I get back to the report. Then the door opens and your boss returns to find you slumped at your desk. Jesus has given us the sign. The temple has been destroyed. He has told us he is on his way. His return is near. We don't have a date. We don't know exactly when he will come back. And so Jesus calls us to orientate our lives to his return. Because, according to Jesus, his return, unlike our bosses, will be catastrophic. It will be the end of the world.
Now, I'd like to invite Peter to come back to engage with some questions. This is a time to really grill him on things he may have missed. There's one question that's come through on the SMS which I'd like to ask first. So, particularly aiming, considering someone who's not a believer,
yep.
What's your key message? Is it encouragement or warning?
I think it's warning. From this passage is a warning to take the claims of Jesus seriously. I think that is the message of the New Testament. Because of who Jesus is and what he claims, we need to take his claim seriously. So this passage gives us a warning, but wider, if we read the New Testament, we see there's wonderful encouragement in living a life trusting in Jesus.
Yeah, okay, sure.
The question is, in my talk I said that basically destruction of Jerusalem, destruction of the temple, sorry, was the only sign that needed to precede Jesus' return according to the Bible, and our questioner is pointing out other passages that seem to indicate that there are other things that need to happen. Most of those come from Revelation, and Revelation is a book that Christians have interpreted in different ways. And some people read Revelation as being essentially a book that is prophesying the future, and some people will read Revelation as a book that is a summary of God's interaction with the world throughout history. And I would tend to read it that way, that it is that there are future aspects in Revelation, but generally a lot of the details are things that are repeated in terms of God's the interaction between God's people and the nations around them. It's a big question. Revelation does open up very, very big questions, so I suggest you do the course on 666.
We've still got 15 minutes.
I think Revelation, I would tend to take 21 and 22 in Revelation as kind of future orientated, but the rest of it is cyclical. You see the same things repeated again and again, so I wouldn't read it as saying these things have to happen before Jesus returns. And so I think the message of Mark 13 is be ready, because Jesus could return at any time. One of the issues is something I spoke about, is that often in the Bible time is telescoped. And you'll find often in the Old Testament, prophecies like Isaiah or Jeremiah will give a prophecy, and it'll refer, the fulfillments will happen at different stages. And so I think some of the language in the New Testament, as I've said in Mark 13, is telescoped. And so some of these predictions are things that will happen right at the end. So 2 Thessalonians talks about the man of lawlessness being revealed. I think that is something that will happen almost at the same time as Jesus being revealed.
Yeah. Another question, probably similar on that similar topic. If the Jews rebuild the temple in Jerusalem, how will that change your interpretation of what you've presented today in Mark chapter 13?
I don't think it will, because I think the prophecy in its original Jesus' prophecy what was fulfilled, you know, the temple was desecrated. What happens to it after that, I think, doesn't overrule the initial fulfillment. Right. Yeah, so whether it does or it doesn't, I'm not sure. That is one strong interpretation. I don't agree with it. I don't think the fig tree refers to Israel. And I don't think... I mean, this is going to open a whole other kettle of fish.
That's great. That's what we want. I think
God has not finished with the ethnic Jews, the ethnic nation of Israel, according to the New Testament. But I think in terms of viewing the nation state of Israel as an eschatological signpost, an end time, a signpost of the end time. I'm not convinced that is that's a sort of significant strand in New Testament. Yep. Yep.
Given that they were using astronomy and mathematics, mapping the interrelationship between planetary movements and climate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Paleontologists and geoscientists have looked at it.
Yeah.
And it's quite interesting. They've got some evidence to back up the concept.
Yeah.
5,200 years ago, the Earth was covered in water, which, by coincidence, is also in the same timeline as Noah's Ark. So I don't know whether you've addressed the topic, but I'd like
The Mayan, the sort of presenting issue of the end of the world being the 21st of December, I think is based on the fact that that's when their calendar runs out. So I don't think it's a specific prophecy. It is just that that's when their cycle runs out. And so even within experts in the field of Mayan studies, of which I am definitely not, there is dispute about whether we should take it as an indication that they believe that the world was ending. So beyond that, I'm afraid I'm not really equipped to speak. I mean, I did a bit of looking at it for this talk, but it seems that it's quite a disputed field.
Well, I've seen DVDs on it.
Yeah.
Science presented.
Yeah.
And seen the original scrolls that were shown.
Yeah.
And the symbolism in it does describe a lot of water covering the earth.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying necessarily believe it, but it's interesting from a scientific perspective.
Unquestionably, early civilizations, their grasp of science, they might not have had our technology, but their understanding of the kind of the natural world of the heavens was unbelievable.
Absolutely.
I am not convinced, though, that the world will end on the 21st of December. We'll have coffee on that morning.
So I suppose one of the key messages from that is that you'd still have to buy Christmas presents. We've still got plenty of time. Amelia, would you like?
Yeah.
So it's a question about the rapture.
Yeah, I think the rapture is simply Jesus taking up those to be with him, but that will happen simultaneously at the end of the world. Yeah.
And that's one of the questions that we'll be looking at in the book, 666 and all that and so on as well. It's one of the issues that's addressed in that book and so on as well.
Okay. I think I would say that on the rapture, people have different interpretations as they have on kind of nation of Israel. But I think the sort of clear message of the New Testament, or the central message of the New Testament, is time and time again, Jesus is returning and be ready. And even if you sort of say, well, this has to happen, this has to happen, but the New Testament never lets you sort of say, well, it's okay, you know, there's got to be lots of time yet. The New Testament presses us to always be to be ready. And the flip side of that is the claims that Jesus makes about himself in tying the end of the world to himself are quite outrageous when you think about it. And it says something about who he thought he was, that he tied the end of the world to himself. And I think, as much as anything, I want to sort of throw that out there, that these are some amazing claims that Jesus makes about himself. Yep.
When I was many years ago growing up as a Christian, there seemed to be a great emphasis back then, as there is now, on the end times and trying to map world events, Henry Kissinger and the Soviet Union, to Pacific references in the Bible. And people seemed, there were a lot of Christians who seemed to devote a lot of energy and had it pretty well mapped out and pretty much all forgotten about or ignored or embarrassingly hidden away in the cupboard. Asking to comment, how is it to stop Christians from diverting their central issue of proclaiming the good news of Jesus' death and resurrection, getting sucked into whether Henry Kissinger is the Antichrist and going to be elected world president, and how are we going to stop this happening?
I mean, it's the sort of thing that's just gone on for a long time. So if you go back to the Reformation, Luther accused the Pope of being the Antichrist, and the Pope returned the favor. So,
the Reformation was in the 16th century.
Or 1900s. So, you know, it just happens. You know, the Bible is an amazing book, and there are parts of the Bible that to us, you know, read, it's very strange literature to us. It's the sort of apocalyptic literature with kind of beasts and dragons and armies and people love to get sort of sucked into that and then try and do exactly as you say, map things. And I think, though, when you look at other parts of the Bible that sort of say, now, understand these things as saying this central idea. Jesus is returning. Be ready. And so I think if you keep the central idea, then when you come to something like Revelation, you interpret it in the light of the central thing. But I think people will always love to sort of try and join up the dots. Yeah.
So it's don't mean to be cynical, yeah, no. But it's always a way of selling books and so on, I suppose, if you predict these things. But
it seemed that many Christians were very good at not actually stating the day, the time, or the hour, but they came so close
Well, there was a Bible teacher in America earlier in this year. I don't know if you remember Harold Camping, who predicted, I think, a date in May.
Last year, 21st of May.
2011, was it?
That's right, yeah.
And, you know, that date came and the end of the world didn't happen. And I think he revised the date and then that date came and it didn't happen. But interestingly, he's come out and he said, look, I went back to read the Bible and I now realize that you can't predict the date. So there's someone who was very visible on the news. I mean, made kind of, you know, international news. And he's come up, you know, through bitter experience, he's learned that you can't predict the date.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any more questions? Maybe if there's any more before. Yep, please.
I was interested in your interpretation
of
verse 30. True, though, so this generation will not pass away until all these things take place.
Yeah.
You interpreted that to mean the generation in which Jesus spoke.
Yep.
So the people who were alive at that time would see the fulfillment. And I think that's a very valid interpretation. But I'm amazed at the number of different interpretations there is.
Yeah.
For instance, one that says this generation, meaning the Jewish nation or the Jewish people.
Yeah.
Would you care to comment any further?
Well, the Greek word means generation. I mean, I think it can mean kind of ethnic race. That would be a very, very unusual use of the word. I think just, 29, when you see these things happen, you know that it is near, the end is near. So there's a distinction between these things happening before the end, and then Jesus says that these things will happen in this generation. So I think that the natural way to read it is these things will happen in this first generation.
Any other questions from the floor? Just finally, this is maybe an impossible question to answer, but
when will the world end? It is impossible.
That's right. So someone on my, this is relating to the topic 666.
Yeah.
Someone on my Facebook, when I put a link to the book 666, someone asked if you believe 666 was a reference to Nero. Or can you comment on 666 at all?
Very briefly, there was a ancient practice called Gematria, which is you give each letter in the alphabet has a number. So in the ancient world, you'd find graffiti, I love her whose name is 543. You know, and obviously 543 would know that her name was 543 and she would know it was spoken about her. So people have said, if you take Nero, and add up the letters, you get 666. The problem is, you've got to do Caesar Nero, and you've got to do it not in Greek but in Hebrew, and you've got to spell it slightly unusually. And if you do those, you can get 666, which kind of says, you know, you decide that it's Nero, and then you try and work out how to get it to add up. There are lots of numbers in Revelation. If 666 is this example of Gematria, it would be the only one in Revelation that actually used that. Other people have said, in Revelation, there's a big emphasis on seven. Lots of things happen in sevens, lots of times. And so some people say for Revelation, seven seems to be the perfect number, the number of God. 666 is the number that falls consistently short of perfection. So it's not something that needs to be decoded. It's just something that needs, it's sort of symbolic of the imperfection of those in rebellion against God.
Great. Thanks very much, Peter.
Okay.
Tomorrow we have another forum. We have Greg Clark. If you didn't like what Peter had to say today, or you disagreed, or you'd like to hear another interpretation or understanding, we have Greg Clark presenting tomorrow down the other end of town. He's an author of many books, including 666 and all that, the book that we're going to be looking at in small groups. Greg spoke for us earlier this year at the Reason for Faith Festival, and we're delighted that he's able to return. So he's going to be speaking at 500 Collins Street, which is down the other end of town. That's all we have time for today. That concludes our session. There's still some lunch available and some items for collection as a free literature or some items in the bookstall. It's terrific that you can come today. I hope you enjoyed the time, and we look forward to seeing you at something again soon. Thank you very much.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.